What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Do reporters have a blind spot about religion? Or maybe several blind spots? And how does that hinder news coverage of all sorts of topics? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Sources podcast. So, let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go in depth with media leaders and newsmakers, exploring the story behind the story. And my guest this week has so many fascinating insights to share. His name is Jeff Charlotte. He's a professor at Dartmouth College and a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. He spends much of his time on the road, interviewing folks across America about religion and politics and culture and so much more. In his own words, quote, "I've been reporting on U.S. and global right-wing movements for 20 years. That, of course, includes many years thinking about Donald Trump and his influence on the Republican Party and on the United States." He brings to all that a religious studies background and is the author of numerous books, including The Family, C Street, and the forthcoming book, The Undertow. You're about to hear the subtitle of The Undertow, and that's going to explain what it's all about. But Vanity Fair just came out with an excerpt from the forthcoming book. It's titled, "January 6th was the beginning of Ashley Babbitt as martyr in Trump's cult." So let's bring him in. Jeff Charlotte, welcome to the Reliable Sources podcast.
Hi, Brian. Good to be with you.
Thank you so much for being willing to talk about your work, your most recent article for Vanity Fair, and all the rest as well. This most recent piece, it comes from your forthcoming book, The Undertow. Tell us about that book project, what you are and trying to explore with it.
Well, the subtitle of the book is Scenes from a Slow Civil War, which is, I'm not sure if I fear that's the reality or am certain that it is, that I think we are inching toward conflict. It's never inevitable, but as I've been traveling around the country for the last decade, watching the country fray and unravel, I had this sense exactly of that of the title, of an undertow, that we are letting ourselves be pulled toward greater and greater conflict. And that's what I wanted to describe in the book and name, I suppose, in the hope that we might start swimming for shore.
Right. We have to be able to name it, see it, know what it is in order to avoid it. I was just talking on last Sunday's Reliable Sources on TV about political violence and how it feels like it's everywhere. It feels like political violence is a daily story now in the United States. Are you seeing the same?
Yeah. And, you know, in this Vanity Fair piece and in the larger book, you know, I've been reporting on the right for 20 years, all over the United States, around the world. And I've never seen so many guns as I did in this reporting for The Undertow. And guns, not just in the places one expects, but at churches. I went to there's one in the Vanity story and Vanity Fair store and another in the book, churches that have militia associations. The church in the story, you know, they've got women's night on Tuesday and men's group, and then, you know, and then a weekly militia training. Another one in Omaha, armed men, and the pastor was saying, "Why do we have armed men here? That's what thy rod and thy staff means. It means guns. It means preparing for war." And that, after 20 years reporting on the right, strikes me as something new.
Hmm. Let's go back in time. Let's talk about those 20 years, because I first became familiar with your work, with your articles and your writing about Donald Trump and about his, I believe it was in 2016, you called him Donald Trump, American preacher, preaching the prosperity gospel, one chaotic rally at a time. And then later for Vanity Fair, you connected the dots between support for Trump and religious zeal that some of his supporters feel. But let's go back further. Why were you drawn to this topic area, this subject, this part of American life 20 years ago?
Well, I've always been actually mainly drawn to writing about the varieties of religious experience in the United States. If anything, I began by avoiding right-wing politics because I thought it was too familiar. You know, I think many of us who were raised more or less secular, as I was, have this idea of the kind of the Southern pulpit pounder, you know, the Jerry Falwell type and the too tight suit, sputtering about the Bible. And that wasn't interesting to me, to be honest. I thought, you know, that's a stereotype. But when you start looking at the way religion works on the right in the United States, you discover something far more complex. I would argue quite often overlooked or misunderstood by the political press that isn't really versed in religious history. So
I agree.
So that's just, you know, it just was like this wide open world that I wanted to explore. And then as I got into it, I said, oh, there's just a lot going on here. And it's been evolving, if I can use a word they might not like, very quickly during that time.
You're speaking my language. I've been ranting about this on TV that we're not thinking enough and covering enough the religious components of stories like the abortion debate and explaining the religious background and context. So if you could spend a minute talking to the political press, if you could pull political reporters aside and say, here's what you need to know and incorporate in your reporting, what would that be?
Well, I mean, the first and most obvious thing is to say that religion doesn't just happen in election years. Religion for believers of all sorts happens every day. And it's not just what occurs in a church on Sunday. It shapes how people live. It shapes what many evangelical Christians, for instance, consider a worldview, right? A lens through which you look at everything, not just the pious issues, but the everyday issues. Economics, for so many, is a religious issue. Race, for so many, is most certainly a religious issue. Guns, for so many, are a religious issue. And I think if you don't have that lens, especially in the United States, I'm not an American exceptionalist, but for wealthy nations, we do have an unusual relationship to faith, an unusually robust relationship to faith. If you don't have that lens, you're only telling part of the story. You've got to be asking at every turn and looking beyond what the pastors say. You've got to be looking into the pews. You've got to be looking beyond that. That's what Trump was able to do, was he was able to recognize that the religious right was not limited by church attendance. There are many, many people who you might describe as Christian nationalists who rarely go to church, but it informs what they call their worldview.
Can we define our terms for a moment? Christian nationalism, how do you define it?
I think Christian nationalism is a term we're using these days.
It's being used a lot more than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, we used to say fundamentalist, which is actually a kind of a historically specific term that goes back to the early 20th century. I always like the phrase American fundamentalist because it sort of got at that kind of merger of faith and flag that informs a lot of conservative religion in the United States. Christian nationalist, the Christian part is fairly self-explanatory. And we should say, though, and again, this is a mistake a lot of the political press makes. They'll say something sounds to them not very Christian. And so they say a Christian is as Christian does. If a person calls themselves a Christian, they are, whether or not you think they're reading the Bible correctly. And that's true of left or right. And I think the nationalism of Christian nationalism, I understand, and I think is best understood, is as people putting that identity first. Yes, it's sort of the cross wrapped up in the flag, but it's not just American nationalism. It's Christian nationalism is part of what explains why so many of the folks in this story on The Undertow and the reporting I'm doing right now, they look at someone like Vladimir Putin or Viktor Orban and the leader dictator of Hungary, and they feel affinity. They feel part of this kind of larger nationalism built around a particular view of Christian faith. I would remind people that not all evangelicals are conservative, and not all conservative evangelicals are white, but it is a white-led movement, and conservative Catholics, and certainly not all Catholics are conservative, but there is a growing Catholic right within the United States that is almost Protestant in its disrespect for the Pope. and its reverence for Donald Trump. That's the main alliance. Now, there's other folks who get drawn into that. I was just interviewing a militia commander who identifies as Jewish. One of the figures in the undertow is a man named George Riley's, indicted January 6th rioter, who describes himself as a Native American Jew. For Jesus, he says, but, you know, I'm going to respect his self-representation. But it's primarily evangelical and conservative Catholics who are drawn together by not just social issues. Again, that's the mistake that political press often makes. They say religion is for social issues. For the religious right, economic issues are social issues and vice versa. There's no distinction. It's the idea of making a God-centered world. And that itself is a kind of view of authority that is fundamentally right-wing. The idea that society should be organized around this singular authority as interpreted by a small group of leaders.
And as we talk about this, you might think to yourself, how many folks in major American newsrooms are familiar with these churches, are familiar, as you said, with the pastors and the folks in the pews? And the answer is too few. It's very, very, very little, very few.
It's too few. And then what you also see, and I think this is, you know, I've been sort of having a sideline thinking about media representations of religion for a long time. The other move that the political press often makes is to assign, you know, give this beat to someone who does have an evangelical background. That's great. But too often, I mean, it's great in the sense that that person's bringing that knowledge. I think anybody can cover it. I'm not an evangelical and I write about it. But too often, I see those journalists bringing their particular experiences and universalizing it. And, you know, that's the resistance that you see sometimes when, for instance, you describe a church like in the undertow, the Church of Glad Tidings in Yuba City, California, where, you know, listeners might, got a little sort of national attention a while ago when they presented General Michael Flynn with a customized AR-15. Which he joked he might use to go looking for people in Washington. And you'll get people in the press will say, well, that's just fringe because that's not their experience. I don't find when thinking about religion, fringe is very often a particularly useful term. It's no more useful than the term cult, which nobody in religious studies really uses. Rather, you want to look at sort of the continuities, the way it's true. Most churches are not presenting AR-15s on stage, but enough are. And then what is their continuity rather than separating them out? And it's really a problem. And I would say, and I'm rambling, Brian, so just stop me.
Oh, I'm listening. I love it.
I would say also, you know, one of the ways that I think I first started understanding this was reporting in Russia some years ago on Putin's anti-LGBTQ campaign, which is sort of stunning in how much it's a blueprint for, you know, things that are happening in Florida, the laws they were passing, and things that are happening nationally now here in the United States. But what you would find is there was this huge, huge Russian support for a kind of Russian Orthodox Christian nationalism, and yet almost no church attendance, right? That people like this idea. The same is true of the sort of the religiosity that I often encountered in 2016, 2020, and now as I'm out on the road, but at Trump rallies, Christian nationalism goes beyond the pews. It's an idea of the United States as a Christian nation, which is appealing to many people who don't have time to get themselves to the local megachurch on a Sunday morning.
Isn't there a connection there to Donald Trump's campaign and support for Trump in 2016 and 2020 in that it wasn't necessarily the most devoted Sunday churchgoers who were the biggest cheerleaders for Donald Trump? It was lapsed churchgoers. Is that fair to say?
Lapsed or not? I mean, I think one of the really sort of smart moves, if I can say that, that Trump made, and I think we're still missing, is that Trump right away knew that he didn't need. He was the first sort of politician to recognize this, that he didn't need the major names of the Christian right, the usual suspects. All he needed was pastors. You would go to rallies and there was always a pastor opening it. The press almost never covered it. I would watch in the press pen as people just sort of, you know, scrolled through their phone while you would hear some of the most right-wing sermons you could hear. And they were nobodies. They were not, you know, they weren't B-listers. They weren't on the list at all. But they sat in that role for people who didn't go to church. It gave them the veneer of piety. It gave them the sense that they were engaged and a wholesome nation, this Make America Great Again. And I think that's grown and sort of swallowed up most of those formerly reluctant religious right leaders or exiled those who wouldn't go along, much as it has with the Republican Party.
Are there corners of the news media that you think do get it, that do provide the right context for this? I mean, I'm thinking about some of the stories the New York Times has written about Christian nationalism, about support for Trump, about, I remember several stories that stood out to me about the role of religion. Are there outlets that you would single out and praise or note?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's lots of great reporting, and I think we're actually getting better quickly. We're getting better quickly on two fronts. I'm getting better, Brian. I mean, I made a mistake in 2008, a long time ago. I published a book called The Family. 2019 made it into a Netflix series, and it's about a very peculiar religious organization in Washington. They run the National Prayer Breakfast. The mistake I made was I included a chapter called the F word. The F word is fascism. And I said, you know what, for no matter how right-wing this group is, and they had literally after World War II recruited former Nazis, they're not exactly fascist. And I said, I don't think fascism is full fascism. National fascism is possible in America precisely because of our fundamentalist history, because too many people would never switch out the centrality of Christ in their lives for a strong man.
Oh.
I was wrong. I was wrong. I think times have changed. I think they have done that. And so in the same way that I think the press is getting much better, I think about recognizing the centrality of religion in all kinds of issues. We're also getting, you know, I mean, you've noted this, you know, the terms like white supremacy is not, nobody in mainstream media would have used that, right, 5-6 years ago. And now we're comfortable saying that. And I think we're getting closer to recognizing the elements of the right that really are not proto-fascist, but have embraced fascism as an ideology. The question is, are we going to be fast enough? It's a little bit like addressing climate change. Will we catch up with this movement as journalists and time to represent it before it gets ahead of us?
And I want to be clear, you're talking about this movement. You're someone with dirty boots, someone that's out there talking to folks, taking notes, trying to record it for history. And you're worried, it sounds like, that we may not all catch on fast enough.
I really am, and I mean I'm out here on the road right now, wandering around Wisconsin, talking to folks post Roe, and always I have this question I never would have asked years ago, but you know, having read historians and scholars, you know, Barbara Walters' excellent book, How Civil War Start, talking to people, do you think civil war is possible in America? And let's leave aside for a second whether or not we think structurally it is. I think what's important is that when you go out and you start talking to everyday people, the answer ranges usually from yes, it's coming to, we've already begun. As you said, the political violence, it's happening all the time now. You know, my friend Catherine Joyce did a smart piece for Salon, and it has been elsewhere, I hadn't seen this, saying, yeah, there was political violence after the Roe decision, but instead of coming from the left, as Fox News declared, it was coming from the right, anti-abortion activists, and police who were taking a very, very strong hand in a lot of cities and municipalities against pro-choice folks. So I think we need to move faster. It's a little bit like climate change. We don't have all the time in the world to figure out how to address the ways in which Christian nationalism has really gone from a part of the American fabric to a contender for owning it all.
I hate to take a break right here, but I have to fit in a quick break. I have a lot more questions for you. Just a moment. More with Jeff Charlotte in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Jeff Charlotte, the author of numerous books, including the upcoming The Undertow. You mentioned you're out in Wisconsin. You're talking to folks there. Let's stay on that Civil War topic from before the break. Where I always come down on this is, what would it look like? So when you talk to folks, what do they say? When you talk about the possibility, what would it look like?
You know, people have sort of different imaginations of this. And you know, as a reporter, that's usually what I'm most interested in, is like, what do people imagine? What do they project? What do they believe? They make that real. Some folks sort of see a kind of a Northern Ireland situation of simmering violence. Some people fear a military breakdown, a divide. And lots of right-wingers that I talk to, right-wingers, some of them are right-wingers, some of them are self-identified fascists, some of them are nationalists, look to the ways in which National Guard commanders in several states kind of refuse to go along with vaccination requirements. They see that as a positive sign. They see that as a promise of schism and breakdown. I mean, obviously, that's the most terrifying idea, the idea of a military break, the idea of a military confused between orders from two people claiming to be president. I think the slow civil war that I think has started is the arming up of people, is the readiness of people, and the fact that we see in so many communities little episodes of violence that, when taken as a whole, start to look like the prelude to, at the very least, a Northern Ireland troubles-like situation.
The other pushback, the other counterargument, I guess, is that we're not as divided as we look like in the media. Meaning, when you hear it on television, when you read on social media, yes, we are clearly pulling apart. There's a tear in the fabric, and it's being torn every day. But then, when you're actually going to the grocery store, you're in Walmart or Target, most people get along just fine, red or blue or whatever. No one even knows each other's colors. Do you buy that argument?
spending a whole lot of time crisscrossing the country. I'm not a flyover guy. I drive.
Yeah. No,
I don't. And I think the rural-urban divide is getting much starker. You know, I count the flags. I listened to the January 6 hearings driving cross-country. Would listen afterward to the analysis. And, you know, I've been impressed with the hearings, but at first this idea that this was really in the beginning a breakthrough, and I'm driving, you know, after Trump flag, and not old Trump 20 flags, Trump 24 flags, take America yeah. back. I'm so many flags featuring AR-15s. You know, it's sort of like here in Wisconsin, people notice this. There used to be Packers flags. Now there's don't tread on me flags.
Right.
But the good news for me, coming from, you know, not of that persuasion, is I go to the cities and there's so many pride flags, equality flags, Black Lives Matters banners. There's not a whole lot of Gadsden flags or Trump flags in Milwaukee, for instance. But you go right out to those suburbs and there it is. And that divide is sharper. And so, no, you go to the supermarket in Marinette, Wisconsin. You don't know what anybody's politics are, except that maybe they're open carrying. That's a clue. But more and more, the colors are showing. And this, I mean, I'm in sort of interested in this great proliferation of flags, this idea that people feel the need to live in permanent campaign time, in a sense,
right.
Permanent yard sign time. We're not there yet. I don't think anything's inevitable. I'm not a doomsayer, but I don't think we avoid that political violence by pretending, you know, as the saying goes, that it couldn't happen here.
That something's happening. Something is happening. How does this relate to, I'm thinking about your previous books, your book, This Brilliant Darkness, subtitled A Book of Strangers. You write about darkness dwellers, about people that are frightened and disoriented, people on the margins. And I'm thinking to myself, there's a connection there. There's a relationship to that topic, to those people, and what you're describing on the road, seeing those flags and seeing that permanent campaign mentality.
Yeah, I really think sadly there is, you know, this latest Vanity Fair piece, The Undertow, was sort of centered around Ashley Babbitt, the insurrectionist who was killed by a Capitol Police officer on January 6th. And a white woman, the officer who happened to kill her shooter in the line of duty was a Black man. And as soon as that happened, I knew that the right was going to make something of that. They were going to make it into a story. That's an old story in America. That's the lynching story, right? White, innocent womanhood and their idea of the dangerous Black man. But as I dug into Ashley Babbitt's life to tell this story, she is one of those people. She could have been a person in this brilliant darkness. Woman who voted for Obama twice, who's, you know, I think a lot of people resent what they call the humanization of right-wing extremists, but I always think you can't humanize that which is human. They are humans. Where I don't, may not like it. So it's important to understand how they, I thought it was incredibly significant, actually. Their favorite movie was The Big Lebowski.
I liked that detail, yes.
Yeah, that she was not who you expect. But she was lost. And like so many that I meet, yes, it is true. They find what they think is the truth online. It transforms them. Ashley Babbitt, a kind of just sort of Southern California happy-go-lucky woman, falling hard for Donald Trump. Very first tweet she wrote was hashtag love for Donald Trump. Going further and further as I tracked her life, and we've seen this story again. You can see someone how they move from a particular right wing view. For her, it does begin with economics. She was in over her head with business debt. It became about race, about moving that anxiety and projecting it onto her idea of a migrant caravan and so on, and it ended in the delusions of QAnon, the idea that 800,000 children a year are abducted. This, you know, a way of thinking about this is a lot of us, I think, look at the right and see a death cult, right? We see all those Punisher skulls, you know, that they use as logos. And there's an element of that too. But I think it's actually an innocence cult. And that actually explains a lot about the centrality of abortion, the imagination. It's like they've taken the fetus and made it a mascot, right? Projecting on to it that the fetus is a sort of this subject that can be as innocent of facts as the whiteness of the right imagines that it's innocent of history. People who are very lost think they are found in this just profound and sad darkness.
And from a source like Donald Trump comes light, comes a sense of restoration and hope and possibility. Now you say you're seeing lots of Trump 2024 flags. Are you seeing Ron DeSantis 2024? What, do you have a read out there about support for Trump and how loyal it still is after all the 1-6 revelations?
Right. I'm with you, Brian. You have to ask that, right? Because that's what we do in the press. But, you know, I'm the same way. You know, I ask that same question, but we're pulled by that gravity toward it is a horse race question, right? And what's really interesting to me, and I think is really telling, is that I've met a number of people with Trump 24 flags who, yeah, they'd support Ron DeSantis. They might support Ron DeSantis. In other words, Trumpism is bigger than Trump now. Mm-hmm. Trumpism, you know, I think this is what Ron DeSantis has figured out, is it doesn't need Trump to carry on. And we, by the way, we see that, you know, Hugo Chavez and Venezuela, it went beyond him, right? He was the left, arguably a dictator of Venezuela, right? Movements often start with a personality cult. And if they don't explode, they expand. So I don't find any anxiety among people about Trump versus DeSantis. People fly their Trump flags and say they hope DeSantis runs. And again, you know,
right.
The idea is continuity between an expanding movement rather than one that is getting contained within the normal horse race.
So instead of asking about the horse race, what's the question I should ask you? What's the better framing for this?
The future of Trumpism?
Yeah, I mean, maybe the better question is there any other narrative? Is there any Democratic narrative, for example, just to name one, that breaks through? And I think the answer is probably not.
No, I don't see a lot. I met the other day with a group of young people, they're great young, you know, high schoolers and college students, and they were pro-reproductive rights demonstrators in a fairly conservative area, and student body presidents and so on. And I wondered, you know, I figured, you know, who do they like in the Democratic Party? Nobody. They see nobody. And I said, and I asked them the same question I asked about Civil War, thinking that, you know, this was going to be startling to these, you know, these nice young people. They said they're ready for it. They said they're prepared for it. They too were armed. and that, I have to say, I'm sitting in a Perkins over waffles with these nice young kids. Like, oh yeah, I've been shooting for years and I'm ready. We could use a different narrative to come in and give those folks some hope, some way of connecting. I'm with all the critics who say the Democratic Party is not getting it right now.
And what do you pick up about media consumption and media habits? Where does, you know, I mean, Fox is the gorilla in this conversation, that, you know, but there's so many others as well. For all I know, it's, you know, something on TikTok now. What do you hear and what do you sense about media and how it's influencing the folks that you talk to and interview?
You know, I think in the undertow, what I was interested in and thinking about was this small D and very complicated democratization by which, of course, as we've all noted this, everyone becomes their own researcher. You know, I'm also an academic and, you know, I teach at Dartmouth College. And one of the great pleasures that draws people into academe is the chance to go into the archive, right? The chance to go to the original sources, as it were, the documents. And that was long a privilege that most of us didn't have. I think what's happening in terms of media is that everyone is sort of now discovering what they experience as this vast, invisible archive. You know, they can do their own research. When you go to these churches, when I go to the Church of Glad Tidings and the story, and there's a speaker named David Strait, who meant nothing to me before this, probably means nothing to you, but if you're part of the Sovereign Citizen movement, you would might know David Strait. David Strait's great claim to authority is having read the original documents and then telling you how you can as well. So there's this weird way in which the media consumption is, I don't find any particular love for Fox News. People believe that they're Googling, they're searching, they're finding their own primary sources. And their primary sources include their friends who with whom they pass back and forth stories, sharpening them and deepening them and drawing them, yes, further into confusion.
So it's the do your own research idea, right? That phrase taken to its logical or illogical extreme.
Yeah, but I mean, we so often make fun of that and, you know, roll our eyes. But think about that. Do your own research, right? Public libraries used to have, and they still do, but people don't call them. They used to have an information librarian, and you had a question, you know, you had a question about when was the AK-47 invented, right? You could call the information librarian and they would help you find it. This is pre-internet, right?
I remember that.
Yeah. And there was this kind of, you had to go into a public space to do that. Maybe you had to go into a library. Now we all know the pleasures of finding things online. This is sort of like my one kind of little hobby horse project is why we are not moving as fast as we can to make media literacy a part of every education. And I'm saying starting from first grade, just how to evaluate sources, how to understand sources, not a civics class, something, a fundamental subject for the times we live in, like reading and writing and math.
Mm. Amen. Amen to that. I know you have to go because what's the reason you have to leave your Airbnb when you're on the road?
I'm an Airbnb. I got to keep traveling. And my host says, I'm sending the cleaning over. So
the work continues. But as I wrap up here, I think that's a really important takeaway about the role of religion and the conversation about religion. This makes me want to go and take a class with you, you know, and I think that applies to a lot of reporters, that we are blind. We have a blind spot if we're not aware of the role, the many roles of religion in these stories. And it's not just abortion in the news right now. Like you said, it's also guns. It's also these other topics that are infused in American life.
It's today's Supreme Court ruling on climate change. You won't find a conservative church that's not thinking about that and talking about that and interpreting it through a religious lens.
Right. It's all around. Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thanks, Brian.
And that's a wrap on this week's Reliable Sources podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you on television this Sunday and every Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Thank you for tuning in.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.